Okay. Hare Krishna. Now this table's a little bit high, so it's maybe for the next session we can get a little one, one a little bit lower, but a little bit higher than this. Yeah. So excuse me if you can't, if your view's obstructed a little bit here. Okay, so we're in Atlanta. This is the 31st of May, 2007. And over the next couple of days, we're going to be presenting a seminar called Srila Prabhupada, The Living Bhagavatam. So I'll just give a little introduction to that and explain the format, and then we'll get on with the presentation. For those that don't know, I had the good fortune of traveling with Srila Prabhupada in 1975, 76 and 77. Just at the end of 1975, when Prabhupada came to Delhi in late November, then I happened to be there. Prabhupada needed somebody to do his massage, and so somehow or another I was asked to do that. And then one thing led to another, and I ended up becoming Prabhupada's servant for a period of 16 months in one stretch. I left his party in March of 1977. So during that period, I consider myself to be very fortunate that I had, I don't know, some inspiration from Krishna that I should start keeping a diary whilst I was with Prabhupada. Initially, I was only supposed to be giving him a massage twice a day, just for two or three days, while Prabhupada was in Delhi, and he was waiting. No speaking, please. Hare Krishna. Mataji, if you want to talk, please go outside. I can't compete with you, okay? Yeah, we're here to listen. Yeah. It was supposed to be for two or three days. Prabhupada was waiting in Delhi to see Gulzarilal Nanda. Those of you that were brought up in India, perhaps, will remember Nandaji. He was one of the original government members of independent India. He was a stand-in prime minister when Shastri, when he died, then Nanda was the stand-in prime minister for a few days till they picked somebody more permanent. But anyway, he was an important man. He was retired from politics by this time, and he had gotten a big grant from the Indian government to develop Kurukshetra. So Srila Prabhupada was in Delhi, and he wanted to see Nanda, and then they were going to go to Kurukshetra, and Prabhupada was going to see if he could get some land there to build the Varnashram College. And Ambarish Prabhu had flown in also, so he was also present. He gave Srila Prabhupada $150,000 to begin that project. So, as it happened, Prabhupada, when he came to Delhi, he had no personal servant. It was a kind of an unusual situation. He had just returned from a trip to South Africa and Nairobi and Mauritius. So when he was there, he saw that things were not going on very nicely, at least in East Africa. Brahmananda Swami was his secretary at that time, but he was also the GBC for Africa. So then Prabhupada told him, when they arrived back in Bombay in November, he told him, now you have to go back there and sort everything out and get the place running properly. And it just happened that in Bombay, there were two personalities who had been Prabhupada's personal servants. One of them was Navi Yogendra, and the other one was Nanda Kumar. Nanda Kumar had been Prabhupada's servant in 1972. He was actually, when the first time I saw Prabhupada was in Sydney in April of 1972, and when he arrived there, he came with Shyamasundara as his secretary, Nanda Kumar was his personal servant, and Prajumna Prabhu was traveling with Prabhupada doing Sanskrit editing work. So Nanda Kumar had some personal problems later in the year, and he was replaced with Shrutakirti Prabhu. Nanda kind of drifted a little bit, but then in 1975 he turned up again in Delhi there, in Bombay, and he was doing some business, selling some Ayurvedic medicines and things like this. So he had come to see Prabhupada, and Prabhupada asked him, "What are you doing?" And he explained. And then Prabhupada said, "If you do this business, you'll go to hell." He was very blunt with him, because he could see he was struggling. So then he was, you know, naturally a bit shocked. And then he asked Prabhupada, "Well, what should I do?" And then Prabhupada said, "Take sannyas." So the next day or so, Prabhupada gave sannyas to Nanda Kumar and Nabi Yogendra, and he sent them both with Brahmananda Swami to Africa to help with the preaching and the management there. So that was two possible personal servants that were there in India, but neither were available. Then when Prabhupada came up to Delhi on November 25th, there were another two personal servants that were present there. One was Upendra, and the other one was Nittai Das. Now those two had been actually on Prabhupada's party in mid-1975. They travelled with him in America, and then they came to India, and Prabhupada came to Vrindavan for Janmashtami through Radhashtami. So he was there about 3 weeks. Those two were on the party. And then when Prabhupada left to go on his African tour, Nittai and Upendra stayed behind in Vrindavan for different reasons. Upendra was supposed to be going to preach in Fiji, so he was waiting for the devotees there to send him a ticket. And Nittai Das wanted to help begin the Gurukul in Vrindavan, and he also wanted to get involved with the deity worship program there. So now in November, Upendra had just received his ticket. It took a couple of months to get it through. And when Prabhupada arrived on the 25th, he was leaving on the 27th to go to Fiji. So he did Prabhupada's massage for 2 days, 25th and 26th. And Nittai Das, he came in also to see Prabhupada, but he couldn't stay because his visa was expiring, and he had to go down to Bombay because that was where he was registered, and he had to, I guess, extend it or renew it, whatever. So he was just there the day and he was gone. So out of four personal servants, former servants, none of them were available, except, you know, Pendra for 2 days. So I just happened to be in Delhi for the day, and on some personal business, and I was asked to guard Prabhupada's door whilst he was in Delhi. I was intending to go back to Vrindavan. At that time, I just finished up being the temple commander in the Vrindavan temple. And I'd just come in for 1 day. I was going to go back. We were doing a mass cleanup of the Krishna Balaram Mandir. It had been opened earlier in the year on Ram Navami. And somewhere or another, I was present there. That was my first trip to India, actually, in Gopurnima of 75. And that included Prabhupada opening up the Krishna Balaram Mandir, which was a very wonderful event and very significant, actually, in ISKCON's history, because it was the first custom-built temple in the whole of ISKCON. And, of course, Vrindavan, that's our home. So it was a very important event. Then later on, I'd returned to Australia. And then in mid-year, I decided I wanted to come back to India and serve at the Krishna Balaram Mandir. So I came back in, I think, early August, and they immediately made me the temple commander there. So I was the temple commander for a couple of months. And then in November, what had happened was that during Prabhupada's visit at Janmashtami time, Brahmananda had several volumes of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, new ones. They'd just been published, and we hadn't seen them in India at that point. So one of the volumes described the cleaning of the Gundicha temple, you know, on the Rath Yatra festival. So I got very inspired by that description of how they, you know, Lord Chaitanya and his followers were cleaning the Gundicha temple. So when we heard that Prabhupada was coming to visit Vrindavan again in after he'd been to Kurukshetra, then he was going to come to Vrindavan, so early December. So in mid-December, we decided to do a mass cleanup of the temple. It was like the first, you know, really thorough cleanse since the opening. And we did it just, you know, we were trying to follow exactly the description that was in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So, except we were using hose pipes, not pots. But we did. We got these moving wooden towers on wheels, and we started from the ceiling and worked our way down. And, you know, we did from the back all the way up to the front. So it was like a really thorough job. It took a couple of weeks. And then we had just the deity room wall, the front wall to do, and then it would have been complete. Anyway, then Prabhupada came on the 25th of November, and I had to go in on some personal business for a day, and then I was going to come back and get it finished before Prabhupada came. But Gopal Krishna Maharaj, who was an adhikari at that time, he was the GBC, and he asked me if I would stand guard outside Prabhupada's door for the few days that he was going to be in Delhi. And of course I was very happy to do that. It meant that, you know, at some point I'm going to see Srila Prabhupada moving around in his rooms. Maybe he'll come out the door. You know, I'll be there for the darshan in the afternoon. So I was very happy to comply. Although I didn't think that it was a very important service. I mean, honestly speaking, I didn't think that Prabhupada needed a door guard, you know, in Delhi of all places. Maybe in America, you know, but not in India. Anyway, so I complied with that. So then the next day on the 26th, then I was sitting in the temple room chanting my rounds. Now, at that time, Delhi temple was not the big, huge affair that it is now. It was, it was actually Bengali markets. It was a tiny, tiny little place. About the whole complex was probably about half the size of this temple room. And, you know, the Radha Parita Sarati were there. They were installed, but in a really, really small little deity room. And nobody was living there practically except two brahmacharis. And there was no room for Prabhupada to stay either. So that the temple was at number 19, Todamol Lane, in Bengali markets. And Prabhupada was staying in a flat at number 9, which was just down the road. Oh, so a small little flat, but it was adequate. So he was giving darshan in the afternoon, and in the daytime he was going up on the roof. He liked to get, you know, the winter sunshine. It's very nice. Prabhupada said actually that this was one of the reasons why the Chhatriyas made India their headquarters, because the weather was so nice. You know, in the winter time, then you can walk around, you know, with your shirt off, not cold. And then, of course, in the summertime, you've got your hill stations and things like this. You can go and, you know, get the cool climates. Anyway, so Prabhupada was staying at number 9 in this flat. And I had gone down to the temple to chant my rounds. And then about midday, Harikesh came. So Harikesh was also traveling with Prabhupada, but he was doing some of the servant's duties, but he was transcribing Prabhupada's Bhagavatam translations and commentaries. So whatever Prabhupada did in the night, he would sit and type that up the next day. And he was also Prabhupada's cook. So he had no time to do the massage. So he stuck his head in the door and he kind of gave me this very intense look. And then he asked me if I knew how to do massage. So I said, no, you know, I've never done it in my whole life. So then he said, well, Upendra's massaging Prabhupada. He's leaving tomorrow to go to Fiji, and Prabhupada needs somebody to massage him. So he's up on the roof right now massaging Prabhupada. You have to go up there and see how he does it, because you're going to do it tomorrow. And so, I mean, naturally I didn't argue about that. You know, I was out the door in a flash. I ran down the road and I really didn't believe it was happening. I mean, from where I came from in Australia, we only saw Prabhupada once a year. He would come 1 week a year, and even that was good. I mean, he came every year to Australia. There are many countries that he didn't do that. But we saw him for 1 week a year and that was it. And you would see him on the Vyasasan, giving class. If you were really lucky, you'd get on a morning walk, maybe one time, if you were, one of the chosen few. And that was it. But that, you know, 1 week a year was enough to enthusiasts to keep us going till the next time we saw him. But in India, the situation was a little different. Prabhupada was a lot more available. He was a lot more involved in the, you know, management of the Indian temples. There were big projects that were coming up. Vrindavan had just been completed. Bombay was the next big project. And, of course, then there was Mayapur. Then apart from that, there was another big temple that was being built in Hyderabad. So there were various projects. And because of the inexperience of Prabhupada's disciples, who were mainly Westerners in those days, in India, Prabhupada was, you know, literally managing everything himself. He was overseeing every single little detail, from, you know, the construction to the, you know, the maintenance of the temples to the, you know, budgeting of the Vrindavan temple. He would sit down there and work out, you know, how much the flower garlands were costing, how much one puri it cost to make one puri, and how much a plate of prasadam was, you know, costing in the budget, how much they were spending for the devotee maintenance, etc., etc. So he's very much involved, and as a consequence, he was more accessible to the general devotees. So anyway, I got this instruction, go up on the roof and watch how they're doing this massage. Jai Shushi Gunatai Ki Jai Shri. What's the name of the deity, see? Shishi Radha Madana Mohan Ki Jai. Sorry about that. It's been a while since I've been in Atlanta. So anyway, I could really, you know, hardly believe it, that it was really happening, you know. So I ran down the road, I ran up the steps, came out on the roof, and sure enough, there was Srila Prabhupada sitting on a mat, his eyes were closed, and Upendra is massaging him. Upendra and I were old friends, because when I joined in 72 in Sydney, Upendra was living in the Sydney temple. He along with Bali Mardown, had actually opened up the preaching in Australia. They'd gone there in the late 69, so he was a pioneer there. And, I got to know him when I first joined, so he saw me come up, he was smiling. Prabhupada had his eyes closed, and, you know, as soon as I saw them, I thought, wow, this is really happening. Prabhupada's actually here. So I offered my obeisances. And sat there and started watching. And then, after about a minute or so, Prabhupada opened his eyes and he looked at me and said, "So?" And the way that he said it was kind of ambiguous. Then I thought, well, did I really hear things correctly? Am I actually supposed to be here? So then I said what Hari Kesh had said, you know, that I was told to come and watch because Upendra's leaving tomorrow. And then Prabhupada just tipped his head. He said, "All right." And then he closed his eyes and didn't say anything more. So then I sat there and watched for an hour. And at the end of the massage, Prabhupada went down. He didn't say anything to me at all. He went down to take his bath. And Upendra took 2 minutes to explain how to do the massage. I mean, literally just 2 minutes. And that was it. That was my instruction. Then I was told, come back at 9 o'clock in the evening. And I didn't even know at that point that Prabhupada used to take an evening massage. So I came back at 9 o'clock and, you know, then I got instruction how to do that evening massage. Anyway, at the same time, it was made very clear to me that that service was only going to be for a couple of days. Prabhupada was in Delhi, he was waiting for Nanda to come. As soon as the arrangement was made to go to Kurukshetra, that would be it. I would be off the job. And Prabhupada was scheduled to go to Vrindavan after the Kurukshetra visit, where Hari Kesh had already arranged for another devotee, Prituputra, to do Prabhupada's massages. So he made it really, really clear to me that don't think you're on Prabhupada's party. You know? You're not Prabhupada's servant, because we're all servants of Prabhupada, but you're not Prabhupada's personal servant. You're just doing the massage, and that's it. You know, 2 or 3 days, forget it. And also I had Gopal Krishna was telling me as well that he had decided that I would be a good temple president for Calcutta. So somehow or another he got this idea. He couldn't find anybody to be the temple president there. Gagamuni was out of the country. And the devotee that was there, Bhagwat, he wasn't doing that well, so they wanted somebody else to do it. He just got this idea that, you know, Hari Saurya will be a good man for Calcutta. So he was telling me also, don't get attached. You know, you're going, when Prabhupada goes to Vrindavan, you're going to Calcutta. Anyway, I was, you know, just ecstatic, really. I got this chance to massage Srila Prabhupada. And ironically enough, a few weeks before, when I was in Vrindavan, yeah, I sometimes would chit-chat with Nittai Das, who had been Prabhupada's servant. And I was just, one day I was just kind of marveling at, you know, the opportunity that he'd had to be Prabhupada's servant and to massage him. And I told him, I said, I could never do something like that. I said, I'm so gross, I would be afraid of, you know, damaging Prabhupada somehow or another, you know. And then he just laughed and he said, if you got the chance, you would, like this. And I laughed and I said, well, I'm never going to get the chance, am I? And I mean, I think the chances in those days of getting on Prabhupada's personal party were minuscule, to say the least. And then there I was a few weeks later and, you know, I asked to go and massage Prabhupada. So I did it. And somehow or another, it went well. There were a few unexpected obstacles that I had to overcome when I began it. Of course, apart from just being nervous, I'd never done anything other than touch Prabhupada's feet once. So now to have to massage his whole body, you know, and put the oil on and rub it all over, and, you know, I had kind of visions of poking him in the eye or something, or, you know, cutting him or, you know, whatever, bruising him maybe. And Upendra had told me that when you do his hands, you have to pull his fingers and make the joints pop. You know, you make them, that little popping noise. So I had kind of visions of yanking off his fingers or something, you know, like this. Anyway, I was kind of nervous, but I had to overcome the nervousness to give Prabhupada a proper massage. And then as soon as I touched him and started massaging his head, which, you know, that was the order. You did Prabhupada's head, then you kind of moved around, did his back, then moved around the side, did his chest and belly, then his right arm and hand, then moved around and did his left arm and hand, and then moved to the front and then did his legs. And you finished with his feet, so it was like the opposite to doing puja, where you start with the feet and you work up to the head. But with Prabhupada, we started with his head and finished at his feet. So as soon as I started massaging his head, immediately my fingers started to seize up. It was something I'd just not imagined. You know, I just didn't even think about it. But because I obviously never had any practice, so all the joints in my fingers started seizing up, you know, like within a couple of minutes. And I was actually getting to the point where it was so painful, I was thinking I was going to have to stop. And I just started praying to Krishna that, you know, I've got this chance to massage Prabhupada, don't let me blow it, you know, please let me just do this massage. And I was just really praying to Krishna, you know, for some help. And within about 30 seconds, all the joints loosened up and, you know, my fingers started working properly. And I never had that problem again, ever, after that. So anyway, at the end of the massage, apparently Prabhupada had gone down and told Harikesh that, you know, he gave me a good massage. So in the evening, I went there, you know, for the evening massage, did that. And so on that first day, I just thought, this is such an amazing opportunity that I'd better write this down whilst, you know, I can still remember everything that's going on. And then maybe in 10 or 20 years' time, I'll be able to pull out those notes and read them and remember that opportunity that I got to personally serve Prabhupada. So there was a little bookstore, the New Janitor bookstore. It was right on the corner of Bengali Markets. I went there and bought a blank notebook, and I just started keeping a couple of notes. So then, somehow or another, anyway, that couple of days just doing the massage, I got then, Prabhupada said that I should go to Kurukshetra with him, because he had to have his massage in Kurukshetra. So I got a chance to travel with him also. And then when we came back, we went to Vrindavan on December the 2nd, then that was supposed to be it. I'd had 3 or 4 days by that time. I was very, naturally completely satisfied. And I had, these instructions. You can travel with Prabhupada's party back to Vrindavan, but then you pack up your stuff and get on the next train to Calcutta. And, Prithiputra, of course, was there in Vrindavan when we arrived. So after Prabhupada had given his class and gone back into his quarters, then Harikesh, kind of stood at the door, okay, that's it. He said, now Prithiputra, you explain to him how to do the massage, and then Prithu, you come at 11:30 and you're on. So what had happened was that when we'd gone to Kurukshetra, Prabhupada had bathed, and then when I cleaned all the stuff up, I'd left his gumsha in the bathroom. I didn't know that when Prabhupada bathed, because he would bathe in a gumsha, and then he would wrap his towel around himself and then drop his gumsha off, and he dropped it in the bucket. He didn't like using showers, he liked to bathe from buckets. So he dropped his gumsha in the bucket, and I didn't think to look inside the bucket. So I left his gumsha there. So I had to go to Loy Bazaar when we got to Vrindavan and buy him a new one. So I took Prithiputra with me, and I told him everything that had happened, because we were all old friends. He was there in the Vrindavan temple. And he was really excited. He was going to be massaging Prabhupada. And I was very satisfied. I wasn't resentful in any way. I was just really happy I'd had a few days. Then when we came back from Loy Bazaar, then Harikesh again was standing outside the door, Prabhupada's quarters, looking very glum. And then he told us, he said, well, I went in and I told Prabhupada that now Prithiputra is going to be doing your massage. And Prabhupada got annoyed. And he said, why? He said, he was doing all right. Why are you changing? So he said, if you're always changing my servants, then I'm the one that gets disturbed. So he said, if he's doing all right, then let him continue. So he told Prithiputra, he said, I'm sorry, Prithu, that's it. So immediately he was very glum. I was jumping up and down. I was completely in ecstasy. And then he said, and also he said, Prabhupada said that now I have to give you the full-time servant's duties, not just the massage. So he said, get your stuff and move in. So that was it. I moved right into Prabhupada's quarters there, and I became, the full-time servant. So anyway, somewhere or another, I kept on writing. I'd done a few days' notes. And I thought, well, I'm already doing this. I should just keep on doing this. This is just a unique opportunity. So I ended up, as I say, being with Prabhupada for 16 months. And practically for every single day I did write, some notes. Sometimes short, sometimes long. Whatever Prabhupada was doing, things that he said, little incidents that took place that might not have been recorded otherwise. And at the same time, I was also... not initially. The recording was being done by the secretary, but later on I took over Prabhupada's tape ministry. So we were recording everything as much as we could, whatever Prabhupada was saying in his classes or walks or in his conversations. And then, of course, in the course of the day, every day, Prabhupada was receiving correspondence. Letters were coming in from all over the world, from different GBCs giving reports, temple presidents, individual devotees asking for advice, etc. And Prabhupada would, by and large, reply those letters during his massage. Now, his method of doing his correspondence was that the secretary would actually open up all the letters, he would read them out to Prabhupada, and then Prabhupada would listen, and then he would comment as the secretary was reading out the letter. The secretary would write it down, so it was like a dictation method. Then the secretary would go away, type them up, put the letter on Prabhupada's desk in the evening. Prabhupada would read through them and sign them, and then they would be mailed out the next day. So the correspondence was another kind of written history of Prabhupada's activities. So with those three sources with my own handwritten diary, with the recorded materials, all the conversations, etc., and with the correspondence, then what I've done is I've brought this series out called The Transcendental Diary. So there's 5 volumes so far, and there'll be 2 more. That'll take me up to March of 77, which is when I left the party. So we've been publishing those gradually. It's taken me 15 years so far to get this far. I'm working on volume 6, and then there'll be the one more volume. Anyway, so it's meant to be a detailed, intimate record of Srila Prabhupada's activities during that period, late 75 through to early 77. Now, I had one very striking realization when I moved into Prabhupada's rooms there in Vrindavan that first day on December the 2nd. So I was there. I was seeing Prabhupada now 24 hours a day, not just when I came in for the massage and then I had to leave again. But just seeing there, sitting, relaxing when nobody was around, that was a new experience. You know, we used to see Prabhupada in very public formats, as I say, on the Vyasasan, on a morning walk, or in, you know, open darshans. But it was a very kind of formal experience. But when you were there, you know, on the other times, it was very informal. Prabhupada was relaxing, sometimes he would chit-chat, sometimes he would call you in and sit you down and preach to you for a while because he wanted to talk about Krishna, so he would just call, you know, the secretary of the servant in and start preaching. Sometimes he did that in the middle of the night once or twice, 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, he'd call us in and sit us down and preach to us and then send us back out again. So it was a, you know, a whole different world. It was an, you know, just a wonderful experience to be more in that informal setting. So this first day that I was kind of made, you know, the 24-hour secretary, if you like, 24/7 as we say nowadays, I just got a very striking realization, you know, about Srila Prabhupada. So I wrote that down. It's in this first volume. This is December the 2nd, 1975. It's extremely pleasurable to be with Srila Prabhupada during these quiet moments. He is gentle and mild in his manner and completely fixed and steady in his devotion to Krishna. He has tremendous strength and force, but is devoid of passion. His presence is totally dominating without being at all domineering. His mind is steady and his senses are controlled effortlessly. His intelligence is perfectly clear, and he knows how to act and how others should act in every situation. His presence thus makes spiritual life a reality. Watching him today, it struck me that he is a living, breathing Bhagavatam. Whatever description of Krishna consciousness is in his books, he himself is that. Reading his books brings gradual realization. But what is understood in perhaps several lifetimes of study is revealed on a second-to-second, minute-to-minute, and day-to-day basis in Prabhupada's personal association. I've therefore resolved within myself to learn as much as I can while I have this matchless opportunity to observe him closely. Simply watching Prabhupada in his daily activities, how he deals with devotees, how he responds to different managerial situations, how he preaches, how he manages the worldwide affairs of his ever-expanding society, how he relaxes, how he continually pushes forward the movement of Lord Chaitanya, and how absolutely every facet of his being is fully Krishna conscious, it is then quite feasible to understand the full import of the sacred scriptures. By studying and preaching, one may make steady advancement, but for me at least, although I have full faith in Krishna consciousness, many ideas and principles are still only intellectually perceived, but not yet fully realized. But by observing Srila Prabhupada, I can see that they are a natural, integral part of his very being. So that was just, you know, very strong realization that if I just observe Srila Prabhupada at every moment, that's the Bhagavatam right there in front of me. Everything that's in Prabhupada's books is coming to life right in front of my very eyes. So all I have to do is to just observe him and I'll know what Krishna consciousness actually is. Now that principle of the living Bhagavatam then, Srila Prabhupada himself brought this up later on, in 1976 when we were in New Mayapur in France. Prabhupada had gone there, he'd been quite sick in London prior to this, and then he went to New Mayapur, he was kind of recuperating there, and he was to install the deities of Krishna and Balaram. That was on August the 6th, that was the last day of his visit there. So devotees were coming in from all over Europe. Because there was the French devotees, but then devotees were coming in from Germany, from Sweden, from Italy, and so many other places. So, by the time he got to install the deities, there was probably several hundred European devotees there. So there were also sometimes some visitors coming. One of those visitors was this Professor Francois Chenique. Now, he had written a very, very favorable review of Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita Tel Calais, the French Bhagavad Gita. And he was actually using it in his university courses as a text. So, just before we came to France, Bhagavan Prabhu and Pritiputra, who had taken sannyas by that time, they had flown to England and presented Prabhupada the first French Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Part 1, in French. So Prabhupada was very, very happy with that. And also, this Professor Chenique, he was very happy with that as well. He thought that, that was very wonderful that we were publishing the Bhagavatam in the French language. So when he arrived, he had an interview with Prabhupada. He came with his daughter. He was on his way to a Buddhist retreat. He was, a bit of an impersonalist by his own admission, but very respectful, very nice. When he came into Prabhupada's room, he was wearing a dhoti. He had japa mala around his neck, and he had tilak on. So not that he was, being a devotee, but out of respect for he understood the tradition. And he wanted to show his respect for that. And he really did think that Prabhupada was a very saintly and scholarly, personality. So, with the preliminary introductions done, Professor Chenique said that he was keen to see Prabhupada's Srimad Bhagavatam come into use in the universities. There's only one other French Bhagavatam, translation of it, rather, that was done in the 1800s, and that had no commentary. Yet, he said, at the university level, the French were meticulous about maintaining the standards of their grammar. He was politely concerned that our translations should not smell of English, as he put it. Everybody knows, if you live in Europe, the French are always paranoid about the anglicization of their language. So they have actually passed laws preventing them from using English words when French words will do. Anyway, this mentality is going on. So he said, our translations, he said, they shouldn't smell of English. He felt that since our books are translated from the English, the French literary expression is not always correct. Describing French as a more compact language than English, he wondered whether it might not be better to translate directly from the Sanskrit into French. Prabhupada was not very concerned. While acknowledging that if possible improvements could be made to future editions, he explained that as yet no French devotee had become a Sanskritist. But besides that, he said, it's not a question of scholarship. The translator must be a realized soul. He said that although there are many Sanskrit scholars in India, they cannot understand the Srimad Bhagavatam. He must be French, expert in language, at the same time a devotee. Then he can explain, otherwise no. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's secretary, Swarup Damodar, he asked, Bhagavat Padagir Bhagavat Stani, you go and study the Bhagavat from the Bhagavat. So I have discussed this in the beginning of my translation of the Bhagavatam. So this Bhagavat, that is the limit of education. Vidya Bhagavata Vidhi. One has to study and take education up to the Bhagavatam. That is, if one understands the Bhagavatam, then his education is finished. The professor assured Prabhupada that he wasn't in any way criticizing, but he was concerned that Prabhupada got the widest possible audience. He felt that an improvement in the way that the French editions were written would ensure that. The Prabhupada appreciated his concern, but he continued to stress his point. That is from the scholarship point of view, he said, but our point is that this Bhagwat must be presented by Bhagwat. And there's not much scholarship required. Just like the Bhagwat begins with the words Janma Jasya Jata. So this Sanskrit word means that the absolute truth is that from where everything emanates. Now, the absolute truth is further explained, Anvayadi Taratascha Abhigya Swarat. The absolute truth is aware of everything, directly and indirectly, of all of this creation. So in this way, if you step by step study, it is not very difficult so far the word meanings are concerned, but it is a question of realization. Unless one is realized, he cannot explain properly. That is the secret. Therefore, we have given the life of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in our Bhagavatam because he is the living Bhagavatam. So that was a nice explanation. Because if you see Prabhupada's Bhagavatam, he's got a brief biography of Lord Chaitanya as his introduction to the Bhagavatam. This is why. Because he was the living Bhagavatam. In other words, he displayed by his actions, you know, the words that are contained in the Bhagavatam. And that means Acharya. Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavatam that Acharya means that, Chaitanya Charitamrita maybe it's in. He explains there that some people speak nicely but they don't act nicely. And some people act nicely but they don't speak nicely. But an Acharya, he speaks nicely and he acts nicely. In other words, he demonstrates what he's speaking. That is the principle of the living Bhagavatam. So this seminar then, I've called it Srila Prabhupada, the living Bhagavatam. As Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the living Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's representative, was also the living Bhagavatam. It's a fact that if Prabhupada had not come personally to the West, let's say he just wrote his books, and his books came to the West, then of course they're powerful, they're potent, but what people would have made of them, you know, how they would have translated those words into practical action, you wouldn't have had an ISKCON. There'd be no temples, there'd be no deity worship, there'd be practically nothing. There'd be people with ideas. But because Prabhupada came and personally lived what he was speaking, he demonstrated it. Immediately there was an effect. People were immediately transformed, made into devotees. Within a few years, Prabhupada developed a worldwide movement with a highly disciplined and structured society, you know, all dealing with every aspect of life. If you look at what Prabhupada gave us, it wasn't just a philosophy. It encompassed every aspect of our lives so that every minute, every day, you can be fully Krishna conscious in any situation. So that means he brought the Bhagavatam to life. So, that's the introduction. Now, what I did was that, of course, I have my diary here, but rather than just kind of read sections from the diary, what I did for this seminar was I took different topics. I took rather than a chronological approach, I've taken a thematic approach. So I've got different categories for the seminar, and I'm going to ask you all to decide which topic you want to hear about. So we've got book writing. Of course, Prabhupada's writing of his books was the most essential service that he did. He regarded that as his most important service. He was always telling his disciples, you learn how to manage so I can retire and write my books. So that was, he said, his lasting contribution to the world. So I've got a seminar here with a look at Prabhupada's book writing. Some, you know, kind of comments from himself about his qualifications for writing the Bhagavatam, about the inspirations that he got for writing the Bhagavatam, about the hard work that he put in to writing his books. And also there's a section of where Prabhupada gave instructions to other people for writing. There's, you know, writing in the Back to Godhead magazine. Of course, that was his first attempt at writing. So there's a, anyway, that's a whole seminar there on book writing. Then there's one on chanting. Because that's the other aspect of Prabhupada's mission. He wanted everybody in the whole world to chant Hare Krishna. That was his mission. Ultimately, everything is designed just to get people to chant Hare Krishna mantra. So, there are many aspects to that, of course. So, chanting, that's another one. Then we've got cleanliness. Cleanliness is next to godliness. So, there's some aspects of cleanliness. There's one on deities and temples. Yeah, Prabhupada's installation of the deities in the Western countries was in itself another revolution. Nobody else did that. You see, all the Mayavadi gurus, nobody's making temples and deities. Prabhupada was the only one that did that. So deities and temples. Then there's one on health, different aspects of health. Prabhupada's own problems, physical problems whilst he was preaching. He was beset by many different health deficiencies. How he was dealing with that, what his philosophy was about looking after one's health, and how he instructed his disciples to look after their health. There's another one on living in the Dham. Yeah, living in Vrindavan. Mainly it was living in Vrindavan. When I was with Prabhupada, he spent 4 months altogether in Vrindavan. And I think we had about 3 months in Mayapur. So living in the Dham, people like to go to Vrindavan and stay there. So Prabhupada gave some very strict instructions about how one could live in the Dham. And then of course, the other all-important feature of Krishna consciousness is prasadam. Prabhupada said that was the basis of his movement, chanting and taking prasadam. So there's a whole long list of stuff to do with prasadam, how to entertain people with prasadam, how not to entertain people with prasadam, and many different aspects of that. So these are the topics, and I'm going to ask you all now to vote on what topic you would like me to talk on. So I'm going to go through the list, and you put your hand up only for one. Right? I'll go through the list and then we'll go back again and we'll get you the vote. Because I've had experience in other temples that devotees, they put their hand up for 3 or 4 different. But just put your hand up for one, we'll see which one you want. So, we've got book writing. We've got chanting. We've got cleanliness. We've got deities and temples. We've got health, we've got living in the Dham, and we've got prasadam. So those are the topics. So I'm going to go through them now. You vote for which one you want. Book writing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I hope somebody keeps a count here. chanting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Cleanliness. 1, 2. Deities and temples. Alright. Health. 2. Living in the Dham. You just already voted.
No.
You didn't?
No.
Alright, 3, 4. 5, 6, 7. Okay. And prasadam. Okay, so we've got a tie. 7 votes apiece for book writing and for living in the Dham. So we're going to have a runoff now. Yeah. So everybody are in favor of book writing. Now you can vote. If you voted for any of the other topics and it's not on the list now, now you should vote for one of these two. Yeah. So book writing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Living in the Dham. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Okay. Alright, so living in the Dham it is. Alright. So most of this is about living in Vrindavan. That was where Prabhupada gave most of, you know, specific instructions. In Mayapur, he was kind of more liberal. Lord Chaitanya is, of course, presiding in Mayapur Dham. He's very liberal and very merciful. So the standards for Mayapur are not as strict as they were in Vrindavan. Just as with, you know, worshipping the deities, you worship Gaur-Nitai. Prabhupada said, you can worship Gaur-Nitai simply by kirtan. Even if you don't do anything else, you don't bathe them and dress them and, you know, offer prasadam every day on a regular basis. Just offer them kirtan on a regular basis, they're happy with that. But Radha Krishna worship is very strict. It's up to a very high standard. And if you don't keep that standard, you commit very serious offenses, then there'll be very serious repercussions. So similarly, Vrindavan and Mayapur, they're the same place, but the aspect is different. Yeah, the mood is a little different. Of course, now, you know, Vrindavan has already had its period of development. It was rediscovered by the six Goswamis and their followers. All the holy places were renovated. Many temples were built. And it, by tradition over the last 500 years, it's been, you know, obviously for the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, it's the most important place. But all over India, people know Vrindavan, Krishna's birthplace. But Mayapur, not many people know about. Yeah, who Lord Chaitanya is, where is his birthplace, what is the significance of his birthplace, not so very well known. And in fact, it's not really until Srila Prabhupada, you know, started his preaching work that it's become more widely known. Now I think in India, at least, I know where I go, I live in Mayapur. If you go to Calcutta, every single person you meet knows about Mayapur. Everybody. And if they see you're a devotee, they ask you, are you from Mayapur? Like this. Everybody, the beggars in the street, the police, you know, whoever it is. So it's gradually, Mayapur is coming up now, and we're just about to start work on building the big temple, finally, the temple of the Vedic Planetarium. We hope to start the foundation work in December or early January. When that temple goes up, Mayapur will become the most famous temple in India. I'm willing to stick my neck out and say that it will become more popular and well-known than even Tirupati, which is the most famous and richest temple in India. But it will be surpassed by Mayapur, because that is the desire of Lord Chaitanya, and that is the prediction of Nityananda Prabhu. You know, when he was showing Jiva Goswami around, then he said, now here there's this Adbhuta Mandir. I'm not claiming what we're going to build is the Adbhuta Mandir that was predicted. We'll leave other people, you know, in future generations to decide, you know, whether it's Adbhuta or not. But we're going to build this big temple that Prabhupada asked us to build, with a Vedic planetarium. And
what is the actual translation of Adbhuta?
Adbhuta Sringa. It's just like Lord Nisringa. Adbhuta means most wonderful, not seen before, extraordinary, like that. So just as the form of Lord Nisringadev was extraordinary, so Lord Nityananda predicted that in the future an extraordinary temple will be built in Mayapur. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur also, when he was looking out from his house on the other side of the Jalangi, looking towards Mayapur, on two occasions he saw a very effulgent city appear right before him, in that whole area. So that's right exactly where, you know, it's in line to the yoga pit, which is Lord Chaitanya's birth site, and it's exactly where our, you know, Mayapur temple will be built. Anyway, let's see, but that's Prabhupada had a plan. He wanted to build this 300 feet plus temple, and that's what we're planning for, and we're just working on the details of the design right now, with the intention to begin the work at the end of this year, so after 30 years of Prabhupada's instructions. So anyway, Mayapur is yet to come. Prabhupada wanted a city of 50,000 people. That means it will be bigger than Vrindavan, present-day Vrindavan. So we'll see how that goes. But in the meantime, anyway, Vrindavan is already well established. And Prabhupada, of course, built his first custom-built temple in Vrindavan with the Krishna Balaram Mandir. And he put a lot of time and effort into the management there to bring it up to a very high standard with the deity worship, with, you know, the preaching that was going on, with the cleanliness and all different aspects. So we'll have a look now and see what Prabhupada said about Vrindavan. So this is on December the 2nd, 1975. As I say, this was Prabhupada's first day in Vrindavan after we'd been to Kurukshetra. So he gave his class and he was speaking on Prahlad Maharaj and his instructions. So Prabhupada told us, he noted that Prabhupada noted that Prahlad had instructed his friends about Bhagavad Dharma during their tiffin hours, although they were only 5 years old. Kaumara means at a young age, and pragyo means sufficiently intelligent. So when one is sufficiently intelligent, he follows Bhagavad Dharma. And this is described by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita as surrender unto him. Prabhupada said that Sri Krishna advents once in every 4 billion years at this very place, Sri Vrindavan Dham, just to teach us this. Therefore, Vrindavan is so valuable. So once every 4 billion years, Krishna comes to that very spot. So on April the 3rd, 1976, Prabhupada was again in Vrindavan. He'd been over to Mayapur for the Gopurnima festival. And then the second leg of the festival was held in Vrindavan. So again, he was giving his class. There were many hundreds of devotees from around the world there. And Prabhupada concluded by saying that we should be very careful to keep this understanding, just like the devotee who takes the dust of Vrindavan on his head. This is the proper mood, because Vrindavan dust is Krishna. If we remember that every atom is Krishna, then our Krishna consciousness will be very, very strong and firmly established. Likewise, he said, the great sky is also Krishna. So again, particularly Vrindavan Duli, the dust of Vrindavan, that is, there was a story that I heard. This was before I joined Prabhupada's party, but there was a British devotee called Charanaravindam, and he was one of the early British devotees to go to the Vrindavan temple and serve there. So when they were still under construction, they got Prabhupada's quarters built, and they were still working on the temple. So Prabhupada was there, and then when he moved in, it was all dusty. So he was complaining, why is this, you know, dust here? Why don't you clean it? So Charanaravindam, he's a very sentimental kind of person. So he said, oh, but Prabhupada, this is Vrindavan dust. So Prabhupada said, you may see it as Vrindavan dust, I say it is dirty, clean it. Like this. So yeah, it's Vrindavan dust, but that doesn't mean that you have to, you know, live covered in it. So anyway, living in the Dham then, there's some responsibility there. There is a standard that one has to follow. You can't just go there and do whatever you like, and just because you're living in Vrindavan, that's okay. It's not. And Prabhupada stressed the standards of behavior, you know, for living in Vrindavan many times. So on September the 5th, 1976, Prabhupada was having a management meeting in his room. And you know, Vrindavan was a problem. The manager at that time was Akshayananda Swami. He was very sincere. Prabhupada liked him a lot. But he was a hopeless manager. And whatever Prabhupada told him, he would say, yes, Prabhupada, like this. And then he'd go off and not do it. Somehow or another, things didn't click with him. So Prabhupada used to get very frustrated whenever he arrived in Vrindavan and he'd see so many things that were not being, you know, done to the proper standard. So he would generally spend the first couple of weeks, you know, getting to every single aspect of the management. Examples just like when he went to greet the deities, and then the garlands on the deities were not, they were either old flowers, all raggy and, you know, rotting, or, you know, they just didn't even have the garlands on when they opened the curtains up. And there was several times when Prabhupada complained about that. And then when he inspected it himself, He looked and he saw the flower seller, what he was doing, you know, because the Western devotees, they just, you know, more money than sense. They were just paying money. They didn't know what was a fresh flower and what was an old one. So the guy would just bring his baskets of flowers, and he put all his old garlands in there. And then in the bottom of the basket, because it was by weight, he would put, you know, rocks and lumps of mud and stuff to add the extra weight. And they didn't even pick up on it. So Prabhupada had to personally, you know, deal with that and order the flower seller to bring fresh flowers every day. That was just one small example. But it was something that Prabhupada saw, and somehow or another his managers didn't see. And there are many, many other examples. Another example was one time when we were up on the roof of his quarters there in Vrindavan, and he heard some noise at the gateway at the side of our property. So there was a front gate, but then there was an alleyway down the side, and there's an entryway just where the guest house is. And Prabhupada's quarters had, you know, overlooked that gateway. So he had taken his lunch and his afternoon nap, and then he was just sitting up on the roof. And then he heard some noise downstairs, because in the middle of the day, the temple was closed. You know, from like 1:30 till 4 o'clock, the gates are locked up, and the deities are resting. So he heard something going on at the gate. So he asked me to see what's going on. So I looked over, and there's this man there, and he's got a bicycle. And he's got a small wooden box on the back of his bicycle, and it's filled up with vegetable scraps. So he was asking for the chowkidar to open the gate to let him out. So I told Srila Prabhupada, then Prabhupada got up and he went over himself. And he looked down and he started shouting at the man with the bicycle in Hindi. And he was shouting at the chowkidar also, telling him not to open the gate. Then he had me call for the managers. Gopal Krishna came, and I think there was a guest house manager, I forget his name now. And Prabhupada demanded to know who this man was, and why was he taking the vegetables scraps off the property. Now, it turned out that he was the brother of somebody that worked in the kitchen, and like an employee, not a devotee. And this man was collecting all the vegetable scraps and giving them to his brother, and they were taking them off and feeding their own cows with it. So Prabhupada immediately dismissed the man that was working in the kitchen. He sacked him. And then he chastised Gopal Krishna and the other manager, like anything. He said, why is it that I'm the only one that sees these things? He said, those vegetable scraps should have been given to our cows. Now you're going out and buying feed, and then this man, this rascal, is going off and stealing all these vegetable scraps from the kitchen. He said, why don't you see these things? That was another example, and yeah, it was a frustration. And Prabhupada used to get very, very frustrated. He really pushed very hard to get the management together there. And then after a couple of weeks, you know, virtually nothing would happen. And everything would remain the same. And then he would just, you know, basically just give up again. Anyway, so he was having yet another management meeting. So he brought the meeting to a close with an appeal to his leaders to be mindful of their spiritual duties. So he was giving their spiritual principle for management. So Krishna has given us some facility, he told them. Now we have got some framework. You do it very cautiously, unnecessarily exhausting what we have. Satovrite Sadhu Sange. So that is Rupa Goswami's line. We have to be very honest and live with the sadhu, those who are devotees. Tandara Charanasebi Bhakta Sanibas. First of all, our mission should be how to serve the Goswamis. Hai Goshaya Muitaradas, Tansabara Padarenu, Mora Panchagras. You cannot act independently. Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam, Stapitam Jaina Bhutale, Swayam Rupa Karamayam, Dadati Swapadanti Kam. That should be our prayer. Rupa Goswami, who has established the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when shall I get the shelter of his lotus feet? Narottam Das Thakur, he prays, Tandara Charanasebi. Tandara means the six Goswamis. H.I. Gosai, Yamui Tarodas. I am the servant of that person who is engaged in the service of the six Goswamis. And we are paying to my Guru Maharaj, Rupanuga, Virudha Pasidhanta, Dwanta Harine. Anyone who is going against the decision of Rupa Goswami, you reject him. So this is our process. Rupa Raghunathapadi, Hoibe Akuti, Kabi Hama Bujabo, Se Jugala Pariti. Who will understand Radha and Krishna's loving affairs unless he has gone through the instructions of Rupa Goswami? Radha Krishna loving affairs is not so easy. Radhakund is not so easy that by force I can go to Radhakund and become a candidate. Narottam Das Thakur, he is hankering. When shall I understand about Radhakund and Radha Krishna's prime? So such a liberated, great devotees, the Acharyas, they are hankering after that day. Rupa Raghunatha Padi, Hoibe Akuti, Habe Hama Bujabo. When shall I understand it? And they have understood it immediately, everything. He's talking. Now there was some of our devotees when they were arriving in Vrindavan, you know, they got this sentiment, let's go to Radhakund. So they would go and live in Radhakund for some time. And there was one Babaji that used to invite Prabhupada's disciples to come and stay with him in Radhakund. And Prabhupada used to get very, very angry about it. And this is why he's saying, even the most advanced devotees are hankering for the day when they'll understand something about Radhakund and something about Radhakrishna Leela. And he's saying, and these people, they've understood immediately everything, jumping over. In fact, Pritiputra, as it happened, when he first went to Vrindavan, he had gone to stay out in Radhakund with this Babaji. And then one day he came back to the temple because he heard that Prabhupada was visiting. Prabhupada saw him and he jumped up and he yelled at him. He said, why are you jumping like a monkey? Who said you could go and live in Radhakund? He chastised him like anything. And he made him come back to our temple. So Prabhupada didn't like the devotees going and living in Radhakund. We'll speak more about this in a little while. But anyway, so here he's making the comment that the six Goswamis are hankering for the day when they'll be able to understand something. And he said, and they have understood everything immediately. Not so easy. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he has given us facility. Abodha Karana Sindhu Kachiya Mahan Pralada Brahma Dulab Prema Nitai Koridhana. That is a special verse, that it is not a very easy thing. Bahu janmanam, bahunam janmanam ante, gyanavam mam prapajite. Don't take things very easily. Take things are very serious. We have to go step by step. That is Narottam Das Thakur. The aim should be how to serve Rupa and Raghunath and Bhakta Sannivas, to stay with the pure devotee who has no other intention. Anyabilasita sunyam. This is the process. So you do it very carefully. So that was Prabhupada's underlying principle, that if you go to Vrindavan, you have to follow in the line of the six Goswamis. You can't go whimsically, immediately jump over, think that you're qualified to go and live in Govardhan or Radhakund or all these places. You have to follow in the line of the six Goswamis. And that was a principle that he mentioned many times, as we'll see. So anyway, one of the principles then about going to Vrindavan is that, what is the line of the six Goswamis? It's renunciation. They gave everything up to go and live in Vrindavan. They were already big zamindars and politicians. They had boatloads of gold, you know, unlimited wealth practically. They gave it all up to go and live under a tree, or various trees, not even a tree, but different tree every night in Vrindavan. So this is the mood that Prabhupada said, that the devotees have to go to Vrindavan if they want to live there. It has to be freed from any desire for material gratification. So one of the problems that he saw when he opened the temple was that householders were moving into the temple there. Not that he was against householders, but they were coming, whole family, kids running around, there was no facility. So a lot of the women and children, they were living in the guest house. So although Prabhupada had spent 29 lakhs of rupees to build the guest house, half of it was being occupied by his own disciples and their kids, because they had nowhere else to stay. So he wasn't very happy about that. So on September the 9th, in 1976, Prabhupada has been taking his massage in his bedroom because the sun is still a little too strong for him to be exposed to it for an hour and a half. During today's massage, he talked more about the householders and the women and children who were being attracted to come and stay here. He stressed the purity of living in Vrindavan, that it is meant for renunciation and not for increasing our material propensities. He said that actually Vrindavan is not meant for the householders. It is for the sannyasis, brahmacharis and vanaprastas, he said. It is meant for retirement from material activity. It is not an ordinary place. But they are coming and thinking, oh, Vrindavan is so nice, and simply eating and having sex. Actually, all sex life in Vrindavan is a great offense. It is not a place for increasing the family. Even so, if they do come, then they must work. It is not that the sannyasis go out and beg and support the householders. This is very wrong. The householder means that he must work. He must work harder than the others to earn a livelihood and give at least 50% to the temple also. He also spoke about the many false renunciates who wander Vrindavan's sacred precincts. They're living in the forest, he said, naked, renounced, eating fruits, but debauchee number one. Markata Vairagya, monkey renunciates. There's so many Vairagis, so Markata. Markata means monkey. Bhaktivinoda Thakur has said, Eta Kali Chala. Here is a disciple of Kali. Nake Tilak Galai Mala. But he's got Tilak on his forehead and neck beads on the neck. But he's a Kali Chala, number one disciple of Kali. You know this song, Kali Chala? He gave a little chuckle as he cautioned us not to broadcast the fate of such a person, lest it got us into trouble. But he said that it was a fact that those who live in Vrindavan and behave like monkeys will take their next birth as monkeys. Then, next life, they'll be liberated. In one life, all their sinful activities will be punished. Because as soon as an animal life is obtained, then there is no further record of sinful life. The animals cannot make sinful activities more than what he is destined to. But their sinful activity is also not taken into account. For a man who is offered this monkey's body, then he has to suffer the inconvenience of monkey life. So then his sinful activities are counteracted. And because he came to Vrindavan and he lived in Vrindavan by the mercy of Radharani, then in his next life, then he's liberated. So this is the glory of Vrindavan Dham. Otherwise, what is the explanation of these dogs and hogs and monkeys in Vrindavan? It is Dham Aparad, committing offense in the Dham. As Dharma Bhajan, if one undergoes devotional service out of Vrindavan, and one executes devotional service in Vrindavan, that is 100 times better. Similarly, Dham Aparad also. This Aparad, when the offense is committed outside of Vrindavan, it is not so grievous as committing the offense in Vrindavan. Dham Aparad. So the punishment is there, but the reward is also there. One life makes pardoned. Take nukampam suchamikshamano bunjana evatmakritam viparkam. Therefore, a devotee in a reverse condition of life, he understands, I'm being punished, little punished for my previous mischievous activities. So now I'm becoming liberated. So then he becomes more enthused to worship the Lord. That, oh, now you are finishing my sinful reaction of life with a slight punishment. Thank you very much. So this is the devotee. Tatenu kampam sushamikshamanaha. Harikesh wanted to clarify at what point such fallen personalities recognize their position and turn to the Lord. So he was picked up on this point that, alright, you do sinful activity in the Dham, so you're punished by taking an animal birth in your next life. But then as an animal, you know, you act like an animal, but you're in Vrindavan, you come in touch with the dust every day. So then at the end of that life, then you're liberated and you go back to Godhead. But to go back to Godhead, you have to have a realization. Prabhupada mentioned that, you know, a devotee, when he's being punished, he thinks, now I'm being punished by Krishna for my previous activities. This is purifying me. Let me take shelter in Krishna. So he feels grateful, actually. that I'm receiving this punishment. It's just token of what I really deserve. Krishna's being merciful by allowing me to continue in my service. So Harikesh was trying to think, well, if you take birth as an animal, like a monkey or something, then at what point do you feel grateful? If you go back to Godhead, you know, there must be some kind of a change of heart there, you know, from being sinful to being purified. So at what point then, he said, the dogs and monkeys, they feel grateful? Yes, Prabhupada said, when they come to sense, then they feel grateful. As dogs, they cannot. As a dog or a monkey, they cannot enhance their sinful activities. That's stopped. And then whatever they do, it is not taken into account. And to suffer as a dog or monkey, that means they're counteracting all their previous sins. So this one punishment finished, and then he's fully liberated. When Harikesh began to ask about desire, Prabhupada interrupted to say that in Kali Yuga, simply desiring is not sinful. But Harikesh's question was about how the change in desire from sinful to spiritual comes about. Such a person takes a lower birth due to his material desires, but to be liberated, he must have spiritual desires. So he said, whilst they're monkeys, then their desire must change. Or is that change forced upon them by the mercy of Krishna? Prabhupada said that if one was repentant, then there was no punishment. But the change in desire was indeed wrought by Krishna. So this is forceful change, he said. That is the advantage of Vrindavan Bhajan. But he added, if one unconsciously, without any knowledge, does something wrong, that is excused. But they are doing willfully. They know it is wrong and still they do it. So then that is punished. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu personally has said, Asat Eka Stri Sangi, those who are habituated to illicit sex, they are punishable. Asat, it is very, very bad. And still, if somebody does like that, so he is punished. So this is going on. Here, illicit sex, these Babajis, I have heard them. They say, oh, what is the wrong? It is love. They say like that. Oh, they take it is love. Gopis love, they say. Oh, the gopis used to do that. Have illicit mixing and intermingling with Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.
So, what is wrong, they'll say. So Prabhupada knew very well. He lived in Vrindavan. He knew what was going on there. So they get support from Krishna Leela. Such rogues they are, these Sahajas. So there are many so-called gentlemen. They write books on Krishna Leela. And they paint picture. Oh, this is very nice. Krishna is advocating illicit intermingling. So they take it as a support of their sinful activities. I have personally seen anyone who is a woman hunter, then he is addressed by his friend, oh, you're just like Krishna. So they take Krishna as a man. So how will they take the instruction of Krishna? Abhijananti mam mudha param bhavam ajananta. So we are teaching people to become Krishna conscious, to become the servant of Krishna. And the so-called enlightened gentlemen, they are taking Krishna as a debauchee, black debauchee. And they take Vaishnava religion is simply sex. Of course, that was the situation when Bhaktivinoda Thakur began to revive the Vaishnava movement in Bengal and Orissa. It was taken as a sex religion. It was considered the most lowest class, immoral, you know, practice, Vaishnavism. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he single-handedly restored the respectability of Vaishnavism. And of course, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur also, who was very strictly celibate his whole life. So Prabhupada knew very well what was going on in Vrindavan. Therefore, he was very, very cautious, you know, about who his disciples intermingled with. And he was very strict and very pointed in his instructions about how we were to behave there so that we wouldn't fall prey to this kind of Sahajiya mentality. So that was in private. He spoke these things, you know, during his massage. Then the next day on September the 10th, he brought it up in his Bhagavatam class. Prabhupada gave a powerful lecture this morning. Madhaji, Hare Krishna. I'm sorry, but you know, this is very distracting if you keep speaking whilst the talk's going on. All right? If you want to speak, go outside, then come back. All right? Thank you. Prabhupada gave a powerful lecture this morning, issuing a strong warning to the devotees to be careful to avoid indulging in sex in the holy dharm, thereby committing offences. The increasing conglomeration of householders and single women in the community is an ongoing concern for him. Although he is not against them staying here, his many recent comments have made it clear that there is a need for caution. Today he voiced his concern to the whole assembly of the devotees. He warned that no one can approach Krishna unless he has a background of piety. Therefore we should be very, very careful about impious activities, he said. Impious activities, we know the four legs of impious activities: illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling. So therefore we should be very, very careful to avoid these impious activities. You cannot make any spiritual progress by simultaneously acting impiously and at the same time acting like a devotee. Just like if you have got dry wood, then the fire ignites very easily. But if you bring wet fuel, then it takes time. Of course, as soon as there's some fire, the wetness of the fuel will dry, but that will require extra energy. And if you put dry fuel, then it ignites very easily. So in order to keep us dry without being wetted by impious activities, then spiritual progress will be very quick. So we should remember that. He explained that Lord Chaitanya had warned against the attraction of women and money for one who wants to advance in Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada clarified that Lord Chaitanya was not referring to a particular gender. Woman means, for the man, the woman is woman. And for woman, the man is the woman. Not that woman means a particular class. Woman means which is enjoyable. So in this material world, the man is enjoyable by the woman is enjoyable by the man. So for both of them, Vishayinam Sandarshanam Ata Yoshitam. Yoshit means enjoyable. So he went on to say that if we're simply interested in fulfilling the bodily necessities of eating, sleeping, sex and defense, then we are called Vishayi. So we should be very careful, he said. Vishayinam, a devotee, if he thinks, oh, here is a nice woman, I could enjoy her. Or, here is a nice man, I could enjoy him. So this is Vishayi. Vishayinam Sandarshanam. To see one woman is not dangerous, but to think of enjoying, that is dangerous. Similarly, to see one man is not dangerous, you cannot avoid. Now you see here on the street. But to see with the spirit of enjoyment, that is dangerous. So we should be very careful. That requires, I mean to say, training. Very strong training in Krishna consciousness. Unless one is strongly in Krishna consciousness, that long habit of enjoying spirit cannot be given up. He repeated the first two lines of the verse, which describe how Sukadeva Goswami was transcendentally attracted to Krishna. And he stressed that our material tendencies have to be given up if we want to attain the same state. Hare Gunakshipta. So you cannot be mad after Hare Guna unless you give up your madness of material enjoyment. So long we are mad after material happiness, then we do anything wrong. Nunam pramata kurute vikarma. Vikarma means activities which are forbidden. Just like vyavayamisha madhyaseva. Sex, meat eating and intoxication. So these are forbidden. But they indulge in these things nowadays all over the world. So this is vikarma, forbidden activity. But they are indulging. Why? Because pramata, they have become mad. So madness is there. One madness you have to give up, this material madness. And then you have to become mad after Krishna. Then your life is successful. Citing Lord Chaitanya, Prabhupada contrasted spiritual madness to the madness of material enjoyment. That madness is wanted. Yugayitam nimishena. That one moment appears to be one whole yuga. So one yuga means 12 years. So yugayitam nimishena chakshusha prabhishayitam. Crying. There is tears in the eyes like torrents of rain. Sunyayitam jagat sarvam. I feel the whole world is vacant. Why? Govinda virahena me. This madness is wanted. Without Govinda, that madness. So that madness was fully exhibited in Vrindavan by the gopis. They were mad after Krishna. When Krishna left Vrindavan and went to Mathura, they become so mad that they had no other business than Chakshusha Pravishayitam, simply crying torrents of rain. So that is wanted, and that is Vrindavan life. Not that seeking after sex in Vrindavan. That means such a person will have to take birth as a monkey in his next life. Because they have taken shelter of Vrindavan, but still they're indulging, so monkey's business. So then they have to take that birth. It is Krishna's mercy, Tate Nukam Pam Sushamikshamana. In Vrindavan, it is transcendental land, so that will not go in vain. But these persons who are indulging in unnecessary sex life in Vrindavan, they will have to take birth as monkeys in Vrindavan. Then their next life they'll be liberated. So otherwise, why in Vrindavan there are so many monkeys? They're also devotees, but they could not proceed nicely. So the animal life means stopping sinful activities, and whatever sinful reaction is there, in one life it is finished. So we should be very, very careful. Dharmaparad, in the Dham. So in other places, if you chant Hare Krishna, the result of such chanting, it will be increased 1,000 times if you chant in Vrindavan. And similarly, if you commit sinful activity in Vrindavan, then it will be 1,000 times increased. So you have to be very careful. So you can't get much more pointed and clear than that. You know, Prabhupada was very explicit in telling us how we have to behave in Vrindavan. He was very concerned about that. You know, I've given you this opportunity to live in the most sacred of all places, but now it's up to you. You have to behave properly. Otherwise, you'll get some serious reactions. And I remember actually one time, just before this actually, a year before when I was the temple commander, Dhananjaya Prabhu was the temple president, and he was having some conversation with one Irish devotee, and he was having trouble, some problems. And he was kind of up and down. Sometimes, you know, he would engage in service. Sometimes he would refuse. Dhananjaya was preaching to him. And then one day he was kind of lamenting how, you know, he was having difficulty following the principles. But then he was saying, actually, he said, I want to take birth as an animal in Vrindavan. He said, I'm just praying next lifetime I can be an animal in Vrindavan, because then I don't have to, you know, do anything, and still I'll go back to Godhead. Right? He was thinking, I take birth as an animal, I can, you know, be sinful and it doesn't matter. Right? Be a monkey, and then I'll automatically go back to Godhead without making any effort. Yeah? In other words, he felt that the effort to become pure was too much for him. So then Dhananjaya said, yeah, but if you do sinful activity, what if you don't take birth in Vrindavan as an animal? What if you take birth as an animal in Delhi or someplace else? Then you're an animal, but you're not in Vrindavan. You don't go back to Godhead. Yeah? So don't do it on purpose. If you go there and think, I'll be sinful in Vrindavan, and then I'll get a birth in Vrindavan as an animal, and then go back to Godhead. But that kind of mentality, of course, that's the 7th offense. Yeah, to commit sins on the strength of chanting. To deliberately commit sinful activity, thinking that Krishna, because I'm chanting Hare Krishna, then Krishna, I'll still get, you know, the benefits of chanting. But Prabhupada said that kind of offense is incurable. Yeah, then you get punished, but you don't get any advantage. So anyway, we have to be very careful, as he said there. Any questions at this point? No questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu. What's your name again, Prabhu? Sankarshan, that's right. All right. Hare Krishna. Okay, Sankarshan Prabhu is asking about the Mayapur project. It's a little off of this topic at the moment. Let's It's 8 o'clock. How long am I going for? 8:30. All right. So we got about 25 minutes. Just remind me at about 25 past, and then I'll answer that. Yes.
So, ordinary devotee or people like us, the one in the Vrindavan, is there a trick to follow him so we don't make any offenses and go?
So, the question is that for ordinary people like us, if we want to visit Vrindavan, then is there a book that we can get that will tell us how to live properly there? Because there are many books now that Prabhupada's disciples have put out. In Prabhupada's books also, he mentions the standards of devotional life. And they apply, but as you can see, especially here, I've included this in my diary, so that's there. And at least when we have our festivals, like in Mayapur, generally we'll put out a festival brochure. So we always list the 10 offenses in living in the Dham. Just like there's 10 offenses in chanting Hare Krishna, there are also offenses, Dham Aparad. So we always list that in our brochures just to remind devotees that when you come here, you have to be very, very careful how you behave. I mean, nowadays sometimes we get devotees, especially younger ones, who they kind of come to Vrindavan and Mayapur in this enjoying spirit. They chant and everything, but they take intoxicants, they have illicit sex and do all kinds of nonsense things. It's like it's become a holiday resort or something. I know that many of them, they go down to Puri also. It's a dham. But they don't understand that they're actually going to get very serious reactions from that kind of misbehavior. So, we do try to check that. You just have to be very conscious of the fact that you're in a really sacred place. If you go to Vrindavan with the mood of enjoyment, being an enjoyer, you're in competition with Krishna. Krishna is the only enjoyer. That means everywhere anyway. But at least in Vrindavan, you have to recognize that Vrindavan is specially meant just for Krishna's enjoyment. It's not meant for ours. We're there to give enjoyment to Krishna. That is the mood, and that's the mood of the six Goswamis. But if you go there, as Prabhupada says, and think, Vrindavan's a nice place. Yes, let's enjoy here. That is opposite to Krishna consciousness. Yeah. So anyway, some instructions is there. This is in one of my books, these quotes. Okay, let's go on. Then we'll talk a little bit more about Vrindavan. So, a few days later, on September the 21st, again, the same topic came up. Prabhupada was repeating it again and again, trying to drum it in. So Prabhupada concluded that material life, however opulent it may be, has no value. He contrasted this with spiritual life. In material conditioned life, he said, your aim is how to satisfy your senses. And Krishna consciousness means you have to work in the same spirit, same vigor, but you have to satisfy Krishna. This is spiritual life. Not that to become lazy fellow. Yeah, karma means when one desires to satisfy his own senses. Prema means when you engage yourself to satisfy Krishna's senses. So why are the gopis so exalted? Because their only endeavor was to satisfy Krishna's senses. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has recommended Ramya Kachid Upasana Brajavadhu Vargena Yakalpita. There is no better mode of worship than that which was conceived by the Brajavadhus, the damsels of Vrindavan. They had no other business. Those who are in Vrindavan, if they actually want to live in Vrindavan, then their business should be how to satisfy the senses of Krishna. That is Vrindavan. Not that, I'm living in Vrindavan and I'm trying to satisfy my senses. That is not Brajbasi. That kind of living, there's so many monkeys, dogs, hogs also. They're also in Vrindavan. So do you mean to say that they are living in Vrindavan? No. Anyone who wants to satisfy his senses in Vrindavan, their next life is dogs, hogs and monkeys. You must know that. So one should not try to sense gratify in Vrindavan. That is a great sin. Simply try to satisfy Krishna's senses. That is bhakti. Rishikena, Rishikesha, Sevanam. Actually, in Vrindavan, they're having like a plague of monkeys. Yeah, it's been going on for years. There's been a debate going on about what to do with all the monkeys in Vrindavan, because there's so many thousands and thousands of them, and they're running havoc everywhere. Where you, now in Vrindavan, wherever you go, you know, you have to tie your glasses on, and you know, anything that you know, the monkeys. I've seen them. They run. I saw one old lady. She was walking down the street. She had spectacles on. Just walking along, and there was a monkey up on the roof, and he leapt down from the roof. He hit this, he bounced off a, like a telegraph pole, and he landed at the feet of this woman. He leapt up, grabbed the glass, like, you know, onto her chest, grabbed her glasses, and then leapt up onto a rooftop. In about 2 seconds, the whole thing was over. You know, down, up, poof, gone. She didn't even know what was going on, and they do it all the time. And we've even had reports of devotees getting attacked and bitten, and so many things. They're just running wild. But I read a report. I can't remember where it was. It was some maybe geographical survey of Vrindavan and Mathura district from like the 1850s, and there also they were complaining about plagues of monkeys in Vrindavan. So for hundreds of years this has been going on, all these, you know, Prabhupada said they're all sinful. Yeah, they're devotees, but they've done sinful acts. Nowadays it's increasing, and I think that's because the level of sinful activity in Vrindavan is also increasing now. You know, modern civilization, or rather lack of civilization, is, you know, impinging in Vrindavan. I think before, I mean, when Prabhupada was living there, you know, the late 50s and early 60s, it was still relatively very quiet. You know, electricity was maybe only just coming there. Certainly no TVs, nothing like that. Now, everywhere you go, videos, you know, they look at, even in the temples, they're watching all kinds of illicit stuff on the TVs, you know, and videos. And of course, they've got all the satellite TVs coming in now, so you see all the satellite dishes. This is how they're spending their time. Instead of spending their time now, you know, going to the temples in the evenings, you know, going around for darshan and arati, now they, you know, you see all the families, they're sitting there watching the TV. Midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, the TVs are blaring. Guru Kripa Prabhu, our godbrother, was renting a room, you know, right next to the Radharaman temple. And then I saw he was coming and staying in our place. So I said, well, how come you're here when you've got a room down there? He said, I can't sleep. He said, all night long, the TVs are blaring and, you know, radios are going and like this. He said, it's driving me crazy. So this is, unfortunately, the current state in Vrindavan. People are devotees, no doubt. But they don't have that philosophical underpinning. They don't have that understanding, you know, purification, following the mood of the six Goswamis. So they're living there. Oh, we're bridge passes. Automatically we have Krishna. And at the same time, they want to enjoy. So then they become monkeys. So, anyway, there was an incident. I'd referred there before when Prabhupada was in the room there, and he said that, of course, don't advertise this, otherwise they'll get annoyed with us. That was because there was an article in the Back to Godhead, I think in about 73, about Vrindavan, and it described it that it appeared to be like a small, dirty little village. Yeah, and there was some comment there where Prabhupada was quoted as saying, you know, that the so-called Goswamis are only Goswami by name, but actually they're not by practice, and that they're doing all sinful activities, and in their next lives they'll have to take birth, you know, as pigs and dogs and monkeys in Vrindavan. So that was printed, and of course that magazine was circulated in Vrindavan, and all the Goswami families, they got very angry, you know, with Srila Prabhupada and the devotees because of that criticism. The Prabhupada told us we have to be careful, but then at the same time he said, but actually it's true. So anyway, the following month, 1 month later, October the 22nd, it was still going on, this business, you know, the householders and all the kids and everything. So the management appears to be as bad as ever, and Prabhupada seems to have resigned himself to the Bengali maxim that a blind uncle is better than none. Right? So he's not saying much about it anymore because he knows that his instructions are falling on uncomprehending ears. However, he's not remaining entirely mute. For the second time in 2 months, he spoke at length today to express his dissatisfaction with the number of women, children, and householders staying here on the temple grounds. He is not at all pleased with the situation as it is now. Despite the acquisition of Taparia House behind the Fogel Ashram in May, and Prabhupada's repeated directives that they live there, a number of women and children are still occupying rooms in the guest house, and this is causing a great disturbance. So this man, Mr. Taparia from Bombay, he had a house not very far from our temple, behind the Fogel Ashram. And when we used to have festivals in the 70s, we used to have to hire the Fogel Ashram because we had no space for anybody. Anyway, they got this house, not a big house, but Prabhupada said it should be the place where all the householders, they can go and live there. That place, Taparia House, is now, it's what we call the Vrindavan Goshala. If you've been to our Vrindavan temple, we have that Goshala, that's that place. So anyway, despite Prabhupada giving an instruction, all the women and kids, they have to go and live at Taparia House. Still, they were in the guest house, and it's causing a disturbance. He has several times complained about the noise, and at lunchtime today, he sent me out into the guest house to knock on people's doors with requests that they keep their children quiet. Because the kids, naturally, they're playing, so they're running around the corridors of the guest house and screaming and yelling as they do. And Prabhupada said, how will any respectable person want to come and stay in our guest house with all this racket going on like this? And even he, you know, couldn't concentrate. Because Prabhupada's quarters were right next to the guest house. So, shaking his head with concern, he asked me, how would it be possible for our guest house to become a success with so many screaming children there all day? If a respectable gentleman comes, he will not be able to find any peace and quiet, although this is supposed to be a guest house, he told me. He's already ordered that some of the rooms in the new Gurukul building be completed early so that all the women and children can be moved there. I do not wish to send in anybody away, he said, but they may not come here and cause a disturbance. He is especially concerned about the problem of single women coming here and attracting the men. This is a great offense, he said. Any sex life in Vrindavan is a great offense. If they have sex desire, then they should be tactfully asked to leave. Otherwise, those who have sex in the dham, then they become these monkeys, turtles, dogs, and hogs. Single woman means with sex desire. They should not come to Vrindavan to live. They should not make a show of spiritual life by living in Vrindavan and then simply looking out for some man. Sex life is not spiritual life. Spiritual life is tapasya. Sex life is material only. One with sex desire should not come to Vrindavan. It is simply for tapasya. The married couples must live as vanaprastha. If anybody comes to live in Vrindavan, they should sign a certificate saying that now they are finished with sex for good. Because they never implemented that, but that was Prabhupada's mood. Again, stressing the same thing. So that's Vrindavan in general. A particular problem, as I mentioned previously, was Radhakund. Yeah, because, of course, the nectar of instruction had come out. And there it glorifies, you know, Govardhan, and then Radhakund as being the most topmost exalted place, and that one should aspire to have, you know, a residence in those places. So some devotees, they read that and they thought, well, you know, then this is, you know, our license so we can go and live in Radhakund. And when Prabhupada would come and he would find out that, you know, some of his disciples were living in Radhakund, he'd be very, very active, angry, and he would actively, you know, try to bring them back. And in fact, this particular Babaji that was inviting his disciples to go and live there, Prabhupada happened to bump into him one day on our temple grounds. And, you know, Prabhupada was a gentleman. He was always very polite, even with somebody that he was annoyed with, but, you know, he wouldn't show it. But this man, You know, Prabhupada saw him and he chastised him like anything right in front of everybody. And he told him, you don't set foot on this property again. He said, you do not take my disciples to go and live in Radhakund. He was very angry with him. He banned him from our temple. So anyway, December the 11th, 1975. I'd just been on the party about a week or so, a couple of weeks at that point. Here in Vrindavan, Prabhupada is especially protective of his vulnerable young disciples, always watching to see that we do not become infected with ideas that will poison our spiritual lives. He strictly forbids us to live outside of the temple, and in the past, he has posed strong opposition to the tendency of some devotees to go off and live in Radhakund, to live with a particular Babaji there. He is very much on guard to see that his spiritual children are not beguiled by envious or ambitious spiritualists. He knows that such people can easily undermine our faith and cause havoc in our spiritual progress. He constantly insists to the temple leaders that they be alert in this regard. So when I first moved there, I was there for 3 months, and I never went off of our temple property the whole time that I was there, except a couple of times to buy something in Lloyd Bazaar. But we never used to go around, you know, looking around all the temples and Rasalila dance and this and that. Prabhupada actually forbade us to go and watch the Rasalila performances in the other temples during the Janmashtami period. So he was, you know, he was very strict. Nowadays it's a free-for-all. Everybody goes anywhere and everywhere. Nobody gives any advice. Nobody gives any caution or any warning. And the result is that we have lost devotees, you know, to various Sahaja groups and, you know, other so-called Babajis and Sadhus who are actually opposed to the principles of Lord Chaitanya's movement, at least in the way that we've received them from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta and Srila Prabhupada. Anyway, so Radhakund was a problem, and it was something that came up repeatedly. So on August the 16th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Bombay. We'd just returned, actually, after the last world tour, and we'd been there about 3 days. So Prabhupada took his morning walk on the roof. When Dr. Patel arrived, they sat for a while in the open air, and they were discussing vairagya, or detachment. Prabhupada told him that if one has bhakti, then detachment automatically comes. Now, I have got some bhakti and some material desire also. No, that is not bhakti. That is markata vairagya, monkey renunciation. That does not mean that I shall stop bhakti. No, you take the bhakti to the regulative principle, then automatically the vairagya will come. The vairagya is not coming, then that means that you have not been a pure bhakta. That is adulteration. Anyabilasita shunyam. That is bhakti. And because there is not anyabilasita shunyam, then it is adulterated. Dr. Patel knows a fair amount of Sanskrit, and he quoted from the Bhagavad Gita, bhakti avyabhicharini. Yes, Prabhupada said, quoting the full verse, he is above the three gunas. So if I am still under the three modes of nature, then that means that I am not avyabhicharini bhakti. So this is the warning. Therefore, Lord Buddha rejected the Vedas. Because, sir, Dr. Patel said, in the name of the Vedas, people were misbehaving. Prabhupada said yes, and he added that just as people then were justifying their desire to eat meat by citing Vedic references to animal sacrifice, so similarly, there is a class of men now who misuse the works of the six Goswamis to justify living in Radhakund. But whether you have got the other thing, he said, Vacha Vegam, Manasa Krodha Vegam, Prithivim Sasishyat. So you were manipulated by the Udara Vegam or Upasta Vegam. These are the urges of the tongue, belly and genital. So first there is this test, Etan Vegam Yo Vishaheta Dira. Then for him, Radhakund, Dhiras Tatra Namuyati. But he's got 3 dozen Saivadasis and he's living in Radhakund. A Saivadasi means the widows, yeah, that are living in Vrindavan. So Prabhupada knew very well. These so-called Babajis, they smoke bidis They have two or three, as he says, two dozen sevadasis or widows. They're having sex with them all the time and living in Radhakund like this. My Guru Maharaj, he wanted to publish the Govinda Lilamrita. So he asked permission of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So first of all, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he said, I'll tell you someday. So then again, when he reminded him, he said, yes, you can print one copy. You were so much anxious to print it, so you print one copy. You'll read and you'll see that you have printed. But it is not for distribution. Yeah, now they're printing and distributing everything in, under the sun. But this was the instruction from Bhaktivinoda Thakur to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Yeah, make one copy, that's all. Govinda Lilamrita. So we are printing all these books for understanding properly. Not that, oh, here is Radhakund, let us go and jump over like a monkey. Oh, here is Rasalila, immediately. So Chutananda Swami suggested that even Prabhupada's description of the Rasalila in his 10th canto summary study, Krishna, should not be narrated in public. But Prabhupada told him, no, why? Krishna book must be there. In the book, it must be there. But you should go gradually. First of all, you understand Krishna, then Krishna's Leela. If you have not understood Krishna, then you'll think that Krishna's Rasalila is just like we mix with young women. And then that becomes polluted. Because you do not understand Krishna properly. Manushanam sahasresu kaschid yatati siddhaye yatatam api siddhanam. Krishna understanding is so easy. If you don't understand Krishna, then how you can go to the Krishna's confidential activities? Achyutananda mentioned one of the rationales given by some of the devotees. Well, they say that they said, living in Radhakund, that's for the liberated souls. So then they said, well, we're all liberated. Prabhupada said, yes, liberated for going to hell. When another devotee said that Prabhupada's explanations in the Krishna book were so clear that they could not be misinterpreted, Prabhupada agreed. So, you read all the books first, then you'll be able to understand. So every devotee, they must follow the rules and regulations, that's all. Guru Mukha Padma Vakya Chitete Kariya Aikya Arana Kariya Mani Asa Asha. Has he taken the order from Guru Maharaj that, oh, I'm going to jump over to Radhakund? Then why does he go? In other words, you know, the words of the spiritual master is one's life and soul. So did he get the word from his spiritual master he could go and live in Radhakund? No. So then why is he going? We are daily singing Guru Mukha Padma Vakya Chitete Arna Kariya. So why should he desire like that? Gopal Krishna started to say that there are always devotees who want to do their own thing. But Prabhupada cut him off. They are not devotees, he said emphatically. Rascals, don't say some devotees. Devotees will hear Guru Mukha Padma Vakya Chitete Kariya Aikya Arana Kariya Mani. So if you want to do your own thing, that's not a devotee. Devotee means he does what his spiritual master tells him to do. Achyutananda Swami said, well, they also wear this Radhakund mati, this tilak. There's no harm, Prabhupada said, but they should understand what is Radhakund and how to deal with Radhakund. Raghunath Das Goswami, he showed how to live in Radhakund. Sankyapurva kanamagana nati bi kalava sanakrito. He was circumambulating Radhakund, falling down and making a mark. So that is the Radhakund Vasi. Sankyapurvaka nama gana nati bi. Not only was he chanting the holy names, but he was offering obeisances so many hundreds of times every day. So that is Radhakund. So much vairagya he showed. So he can take bath in Radhakund. First of all, you do like Raghunath Goswami. As he left the roof, Prabhupada cautioned us once more about Radhakund. He said that we should not bathe in Radhakund, but we should simply touch the water to our head. He said that unless one is very respectful to the lotus feet of Radharani, they cannot bathe there. It is only for the very advanced souls. So we'll talk more about Radhakund tomorrow. Shankarshan Prabhu had a... Shankarshan, right? He had a question about what's happening in Mayapur. So, just briefly, the GBC this year gave their approval to build the new temple in the what we call the park area of the existing temple complex. There are many trusts that own the land all around us that have been set up, you know, to get that land. And originally we were thinking to build on the back of that land, like behind the existing temple. But unfortunately, we've run into some difficulties with the West Bengal government. I won't go into the technicalities of it. But what it means is that we're not going to be able to use that land or build on that land for quite a long time. In the meantime, you know, it's 30 years now since Prabhupada gave, or more than 30 years since Prabhupada gave the instruction to build, you know, this temple of the Vedic planetarium. And we're now in a position, really, for the first time, where we think that we can actually do it. The money's there. Ambarish Prabhu has come forward and he's guaranteed at least 20 million for the first phase. And we have, you know, men who have the expertise. We've hired engineers that have worked on very big projects in Delhi and other places. And, you know, this question of the land, last year somebody realized that, you know, although we have so many obstacles building on the other land at the back, we've got this plot right in the middle of our complex where the, you know, the present park and the deer park was. That's big. That may be big enough to build, you know, the new temple on. And it's ISKCON land. It's, you know, the trust is ISKCON. So the GBC last year gave approval to do a feasibility study to see if we could actually get what we want on that land. And then this year they just passed a resolution giving the go-ahead. So from the front gate up to Radhamadava's temple, or rather, you know, you've got Prabhupada's Bhajan Kutir on the left-hand side of the gate as you come in. So from there up to the Lotus building, and from the long building all the way out to where the deer park was, that area is going to be cleared.